Hello everyone and welcome to this new session of Memcast. We're delighted to be joined once again by Professor James Burton, nephrology consultant in Leicester, and we're going to discuss a very important topic today. We're going to discuss a few encounters with hemodialysis patients specifically and hemodialysis emergencies that you guys can encounter in your day-to-day on calls, especially if you're covering a district general hospital and probably the renal team is not on site. So we're going to discuss the basics. Thank you so much for joining us.
That's all right, Christina. We thought about what we might cover today, and of course there's lots of emergencies that hemodialysis patients might present with, but some of them are more specialist that potentially wouldn't necessarily be communicated to trainees at sort of IMT level. So we're going to keep it to the basics, some of the emergencies that anybody might be called to, or some of the things that you might be asked to give advice about over the telephone.
Okay, so should we start off with a clinical case?
Let's do that.
So let's talk about a 60-year-old lady that's dialyzing through a tunnel dialysis line and comes into A&E, sent from the dialysis unit with pyrexia. Her observations are taken in on arrival to A&E, and she's scoring on temperature, blood pressure, and heart rate. Currently, her temperature is 38.5. She has a heart rate of 110, and her blood pressure is slightly on the lower side, 90 over 60 millimeters mercury. She's very keen on going home, and on arrival to
A&E,
as always. And on arrival to ED, the paramedics actually called the medical registrar on call and asked for advice. What would you recommend in this type of case?
So this is just like everything. We just need to be really certain that we don't start traveling down a path because of potential preconceived ideas that we have before we've even spoken to the patient. So what do I mean by that? So we all know that dialysis patients represent quite an unwell population who live with a chronic disease. And you might think, okay, well, they've been on dialysis, so they've come straight from the dialysis unit. You might even see them on the dialysis unit if that's attached to your hospital. But nevertheless, they've just finished their dialysis. So you might be thinking, well, I've heard that dialysis patients often get low blood pressure after dialysis. You know, maybe they're a little bit tachycardic. And so you might be lulled into a slight false sense of security that that's normal physiology for somebody after they've been on dialysis. So the first thing to remember is something that is true for all medical patients, that we should get rid of our preconceived ideas. And when we're assessing somebody, just make sure we go back to those fundamentals of taking a history and doing a proper examination. So that would be the first thing that I would say. So then we've essentially got in front of us is someone who is shocked. So they've got a low blood pressure and they're tachycardic, and I guess with some evidence that they are not perfusing their tissues properly. And so think, okay, so here is somebody with shock that I'm going up to. What are those causes of shock that I can remember? And so you might rank those. There's five causes of shock or categories of shock. I always use this example of somebody who presents with pancreatitis. The first one that you talk about would not be scorpion bite in an ED in the UK. And it's the same even when you're thinking about someone with shock. So the first on your list would not be neurogenic shock. That might be bottom of your list. So you would rank them and you might think, well, this is someone with a temperature. So septic shock is first. A dialysis patient, so cardiogenic shock would be important, hypovolemic shock or anaphylactic shock, but neurogenic shock would be at the bottom of my list. So that's how I would think about it. I'm approaching the patient, thinking, okay, maybe they're shocked, they've got a temperature, so septic shock is right up there. So that's what I would be thinking, and then think, right, I'm going to take a history and do my examination and then take it from there. So what you've given me from the history is that they dialyzed through a tunneled catheter.
Yes.
So they've got a central venous catheter that they use for their dialysis. That's their lifeline. And so they've got a temperature they've got a central venous line and they've got other signs of sepsis. And so really, you know, there might well be other elements of the history that would contribute to my understanding of that patient to the degree of sepsis. You've also told me that they're quite keen to go home.
Yeah.
So they're clearly having a conversation. They've probably got, you know, a relatively preserved GCS. They're not confused. They might be confused. You don't know that. But I think the key is, irrespective of all of those things, for someone on dialysis, well, anybody really, who's got a central venous catheter, who presents with a temperature, then the diagnosis is that they've got a catheter infection until proven otherwise. And I think you and I know from people that we have seen on the dialysis unit that these individuals can deteriorate really rapidly, going from signs of infection to signs of sepsis with a very significant bacteremia. And that they can fall off that precipice really quickly. And so from an IMT perspective, using those, whatever your local sepsis pathway would be, to make sure that they get intravenous antibiotics within the right time frame is going to be really important. And of course, having cultures taken before that, ideally. So I think that's what the key message would be, irrespective of what your preconceived ideas might be, and irrespective of what the patient might be wanting to do, like discharging and going home, that these are really vulnerable individuals, and that anybody with a central line has got a catheter-related infection, still proven otherwise.
Okay, and because you mentioned cultures in general and antibiotics, and talking about accessing a dialysis patient and who is supposed to actually take those cultures and who's supposed to actually manage the antibiotics after they're admitted into hospital or if they go home?
Yeah. So that's a really good question. And I think what we know, and I've seen in my personal practice, and we know from guideline documents that have been published, is that there are intrinsic risks for people who aren't used to managing lines in their day-to-day practice. There are risks associated with that. So clearly, if someone is peri-arrest and you need central access, then you should open the line up in that emergency situation, because the benefits of having that access there outweigh the risks that you might get if you're not used to using those lines. But for things like blood cultures, taking bloods, using that line for, let's say, IV antibiotic administration, you have to think very carefully about whether doing that through the central line, the benefit of that is outweighed by the risks of, for example, infection if you're not used to opening a line and using proper aseptic non-touch technique, locking the line and flushing it properly to make sure that you don't get clots in the line and you don't affect the integrity of the line. And of course, there are very rare but real instances of air embolus, where air has been introduced through the line and caused significant complications or even death. So we have to be really thoughtful about that. And ideally, if you're getting calls from the dialysis unit, then your skilled and trained staff are right there to take those cultures if you ask them to do that. And they're very used to doing that. But generally speaking, for people who aren't trained and regularly doing it, think very carefully about whether that's the right thing to do and whether the benefits outweigh the risks.
Okay. And also, they have to bear in mind that dialysis patients have different doses of antibiotics and they need to be given with dialysis if possible.
I think that's right. I think, you know, we need to be thoughtful about the fact that, you know, catheter-associated bacteremia is, you may well have a protocol for that in your local hospitals, dependent upon which pathogen is most common. There may be, for example, considerations around whether the antibiotics are dialyzed out, so timing with dialysis. So you're absolutely right about that, Christina. I mean, the key would be to ensure that an appropriate antibiotic is administered in that first hour, and then after that, taking advice. But I'm sure most hospitals have got a local policy on that that people could look up if they don't have the opportunity to discuss that with one of the renal team in that moment.
Okay, great. Now, changing the scenario a bit.
Okay.
The same lady dialyzes through a tunnel line, comes into ED. She's not that keen on going home. She is hypotensive still. let's say 80 over 60, she's still tachycardic at 105. Her GCS is 14 out of 15. She's a bit drowsy, but rouseable.
Okay.
And she doesn't have a pyrexia.
Okay.
How would the management change then?
Okay, so that's a really great question. And I guess, given all of the things that we talked about earlier, she's shocked. She's obviously got a low blood pressure again and a tachycardia, and she's not cerebrating 100%, so she's shocked. But now without a temperature, you might be thinking of other causes of shock that are higher up on your list of priorities. And I guess the fact that she's drowsy means that the history might be a little bit more tricky. You might be trying to collect a collateral history if things aren't necessarily as forthcoming from that individual. But I guess there's two things to consider here. The first thing is that dialysis patients have an incredibly high cardiovascular risk, somewhere potentially 50 times higher than the non-dialysis population. And so cardiovascular events are incredibly common in the dialysis population. So we have to think really, really carefully about that. So an ECG and thinking really carefully about that individual's cardiovascular history are going to be absolutely crucial, because it could be cardiogenic shock. So that's the first thing to think about. And then obviously the investigations and appropriate management onwards from that. But the other thing to bear in mind is hypovolemic shock. And for anyone who's been on the dialysis unit, will know that actually the dialysis machines deliver two different therapies. One is dialysis for removal of solutes and waste products, and the other is ultrafiltration for removal of water. And dependent on individuals' fluid gains between their dialysis sessions will dictate the amount of fluid that is ultrafiltrated between their two dialysis sessions. And if someone drinks a lot of fluid, or it's their long interdialytic break, so for somebody who dialyzes on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, for example, there's a shorter gap between their Monday and Wednesday dialysis sessions as there is between their Friday and Monday dialysis sessions. So just by nature of the fact that they've got longer time to have more to eat and drink, then the amount of fluid that is removed in a single dialysis session will be higher. Even though the time during which that fluid is removed, for most people that's 4 hours, it's the same. So you're removing more fluid over the same amount of time, and that has the potential to make people hypovolemic by reducing their intravascular volume quite quickly, and they become shocked. So that's the physiology behind that. So what can we do about that? Well, very simply, replacing their intravascular fluid volume can sort that out very, very quickly. So if they're in ED and they look a little bit dehydrated and there's signs that their intravascular fluid volume is low, then a small bolus of intravenous fluids could correct that very, very quickly, actually. It'd be unusual, I think, Christine, you'd probably agree, to see that in the ED, because the dialysis unit staff are really experienced and quite often will give a small bolus of 100 or 200 mils of fluid and correct that very, very quickly. Yeah. But that is certainly the first and easiest consideration. And, you know, listeners might be thinking, oh no, dialysis patients, I'm really reluctant to give them boluses of IV fluids because if they don't pass urine, that can cause complications. And of course that is right. So a really thoughtful assessment of intravascular fluid status, including that dreaded jugular venous pulsation, which is really difficult to assess, but really crucial to your physical exam in people like this, would help you. But ultimately, a small bolus of crystalloids, 100, 200 mils, and seeing if that gives you a response is going to be safe and could potentially put things right really, really quickly. So that's hypovolemic shock and cardiogenic shock. If we're thinking a little bit more about low blood pressure in a chronic situation, so this is perhaps a little bit outside of what IMTs might see, but again, you know that dialysis is physiologically quite a demanding process. So if the average pump speed on a dialysis machine might be 300 or 400 mils of blood per minute, so 400 mils a minute, that's almost a litre every 2 minutes for 240 minutes. So that tells you just how many or how quickly the blood is put around that system. And so why do I mention that? Well, the key is that it's physiologically a really demanding process, and that can have an effect on blood pressure, as can the amount of fluid that is ultrafiltrated off. And so it's not uncommon for individuals to have a lower blood pressure at the end of their treatment than they do when they arrive on the dialysis unit. And for some people that can mean that their dialysis is less efficient because we have to slow the pump speeds down, or they get removed earlier because they get symptoms. So how can we address that? Well, obviously medication review is really important, thinking really carefully about fluid balance and how we can optimize their fluid balance through use of diuretics, or talking to dietitians about fluid restrictions. But there are other ways that we can optimize the dialysis prescription. So that might be lengthening the time to reduce the ultrafiltration rate. We can cool the dialysis fluid down because that maintains core blood pressure. So that's another way of doing it. Or we can think about other strategies to preserve their blood pressure. But I guess that's more of a chronic thing, and you were asking me about acute. But yeah, that's other strategies that we can use to maintain blood pressure for people who have got a particularly difficult cardiovascular status.
Okay, and to round things up, thank you so much. I hope this is going to be very useful for our listeners. People, as you said, are scared of dialysis patients. And what would be your top tips for IMTs that see a hemodialysis patient with either an acute or a chronic issue, if they come into an acute medical ward? What would be your top tips for them not to get scared of?
Okay, so I think just like anything else, is that dialysis patients or people on dialysis, they know about their condition. So I remember somebody said to me, you know, the best thing for people with complicated diabetes is to listen to the patient, because they'll know more about their treatment regimen than you do. They'll know more about the consequences of changing the doses of their medications than you might. And ultimately, you know, be really guided by your patient. And that is definitely true for the dialysis population as well. Really listen to what they're saying. If they're saying they don't feel well, it's because they don't feel well. And for individuals that undertake that treatment for 4 hours a session for three times a week, who spend a lot of their time in hospital, they don't want to be in hospital unless they absolutely have to. So if they're saying they don't feel well, it's because they really are not well. But similarly, the flip side of that is they spend a lot of time in hospital. So they're going to want to try and negotiate leaving hospital or not being admitted. And the key would be to think about resilience around that. If you've got a gut feeling that somebody's not well, yes, of course, listen to that individual. But if you feel uncomfortable with not admitting an individual, then make sure that that is definitely discussed with one of the renal team.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us. I hope it was going to be useful and it's going to ease our listeners' stress when dealing with dialysis patients.
Thanks, Christine. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us, and join us next week for a new episode.